Welcome to the UNLV Gaming Podcast, presented by the Center for Gaming Research at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Furthering the public's understanding of gambling and casinos with a mix of lectures and conversations available 24/7 to the world online. Welcome. Today is April 12th, 2012. Welcome to the April UNLV Gaming Research Colloquium. Our speaker today is Christopher Wetzel, who's an assistant professor of sociology at Stonehill College, and he's looking at how race, class, and gender have shaped debates over gaming legalization since the 30s. And here in Nevada, he's focusing more on Nevada and taking this into some very interesting directions. So please, let's welcome Dr. Wetzel.
Thank you, Dr. David Schwartz, for the generous introduction, and the beautiful thing now is that I don't have to use my phone to keep track of time. So thank you all for being here and sort of making time sort of amidst your afternoon. And again, I'm really grateful to Dave and to the folks at the Gaming Research Center for having me here this week. You know, one of the huge luxuries of my job is that I get to meet a lot of people who are passionate about their work, and certainly the good people here in Special Collections at UNLV are no exception. And so thank you for the hospitality and the generosity that you've shown me this week. I also want to give sort of one more thanks to a person who isn't here today. That would be Kim Luciano, who is an undergrad at Stonehill College, and she's been my research assistant on this project for the last year on the lottery component. And so just to give you a bit of a sense of who I am, you know, I came to this work on sort of gaming legalization out of a background doing work with tribal nations. For the last 10 years, I've been working with the Potawatomi Nation that sort of is scattered from Oklahoma all the way on up through parts of northern Ontario, really trying to understand and theorize what does national revitalization mean for this community in sort of the processes that they've been going through over the last 40 years. And so gaming is part of, although not necessarily integral to, that story. And so what struck me, though, as I was thinking about the experiences of tribal nations, and in moving from the West Coast, where I had done my PhD and my postdoc, back to the East Coast to take my faculty position at Stonehill, was that Governor Deval Patrick, the governor of Massachusetts, did precisely what I was waiting for a governor to do in 2007. And that was to say that when the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe had reaffirmed their relationship with the federal government and approached the governor to negotiate a gaming compact under the terms of IGRA, the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, he demurred and in that moment said, well, if Massachusetts is going to get into casinos, then we're going to do it right, and we're going to do it fair, and we're going to require tribes to compete just like other gaming enterprises. And so in this moment of thinking about the particularity and really the peculiarity of gaming in the East and the ways in which I think as of late this has become kind of intertwined with notions of sort of tribes and racial identities, I really want to try and sort of deepen and better theorize this conversation by looking at the experience of different waves of gaming legalization. So in turn, that's what I've done. And really, I've focused most of my research on Massachusetts, but again, through the sort of gracious support of the Center for Gaming Research and the fellowship that they've given me, I'm trying to begin broadening out this story. And so what I'm going to talk to you about today is really just the lottery component of this project. But really, when I'm thinking about gaming legalization, what I'm thinking about are waves here. And so in Massachusetts, we had three waves, right? In 1934, we legalized pari-mutuel wagering, right? That is sort of betting against other players, typically for thoroughbred racing, harness racing, or for greyhounds. Sometimes highlie was popular, but not as much anymore. So we did pari-mutuel wagering in 1934. Massachusetts legalized its own lottery in 1971. And now, just shy of 12 months ago, in 2011, we passed a bill legalizing casino gaming. But in this really fascinating way, I think Nevada becomes a wonderful comparative case for Massachusetts, because Nevada has also had parallel waves. So in 1931, as most of you know, Nevada legalized casino gaming. In 1975, Nevada legalized pari-mutuel wagering. And now there's kind of been an ongoing debate for the last number of years about the prospects of establishing a state lottery. And so clearly I should have been here a couple of years ago when we had sort of the Mega Millions bonanza, sort of the $600 million prize. But for, I think I only missed 4 out of 6 numbers in the quick pick. Otherwise, I totally would have bailed on you, Dave, if I had become a half a billionaire. Sorry. But alas, I didn't. And so my arrival in Nevada 2 weeks later has been anticipated rather well by a number of media outlets, including sort of the Review Journal and The Sun, all of which published articles posing the question, why does Nevada not have its own lottery? And so this is what I actually want to try and sort of delve into a little bit today. And so when we're thinking about these waves, and in particular when we're looking at lotteries, I think we have to ask 3 questions within kind of this moment of waves. We have to look at patrons, right? Who is actually going to go and play these games? We have to look at proceeds, right? What is going to happen with the revenues generated? And from what I understand, this is actually the subject of occupational, or sort of the occasional paper number 16 that just got published, right? What do states actually do with the money that comes in? Little shout out for my peers here. So indeed, right, patrons, number one, right? Who plays the game? Proceeds, what happens with the money that gets generated? And issue number 3 is the proprietors, right? Who actually gets to run the game? And so when it comes to the lottery, the sequencing of these waves, right? In what order are we legalizing different forms of gaming? It matters, and it especially matters, I'll argue today, for the ways in which proprietors get portrayed, right? So I actually think there's really striking, as we were talking about a little bit earlier, there's some amazingly interesting parallels in Massachusetts and Nevada about sort of arguments and sort of debates about sort of who are the patrons, right? Oftentimes this gets portrayed as being, the lottery does, as being a regressive tax, as displacing other discretionary spending. These were parallel in both Massachusetts and Nevada. There are parallels around proceeds, right? What's going to happen with this money? To the extent that in both cases, there was clearly a focus on trying to earmark the money, the revenues, for specific purposes, right? Sort of allocating that money not just into the big general fund, but doing it towards some kind of good cause. But then here we come to what I think is really the most important moment of divergence, which is around the proprietors here. And in Massachusetts, in 1970 and 1971, the big fear was about Massachusetts sort of falling into and sort of becoming part of the criminal rackets and sort of the numbers game, that somehow Massachusetts would lose its place as being the Athens of America if indeed it sort of got into the ugly and sort of questionable business of gaming. By contrast, in Nevada, what's so striking as I look at sort of the archival material here is that the fear is much more focused upon the state becoming a competitor to the existing casino games, right? So again, think about this, right? In Massachusetts, it's about sort of the state becoming sort of criminal or sort of, you know, sort of becoming sort of immoral, whereas in Nevada, it's really about sort of competition in the marketplace. And I would argue that as we begin thinking about Nevada, right, and when I look at some of these articles that have been published over the last couple of weeks in posing this question, why is there no Nevada lottery? In many ways, it's not a moral argument anymore. We have other forms of gaming, and so it should be non-problematic. I want to argue to you today that what's happening in Nevada is a profoundly moral argument about the lottery and about the state. And this may not be sort of morality in, say, sort of the religious sense. It may not sort of be morality in kind of the broader ethical sense. But what I want to argue today is that sort of the debates around proprietors and Nevada's lottery really focus upon the morality of markets, right? In a moment of neoliberalism, I think this is kind of what is central to the debate in Nevada. So in the time that I have with you today, I want to just talk very briefly about how the lottery is a distinctive kind of social problem, to outline a history of lotteries, and then to really kind of talk about what's happened in Nevada since the 1960s. Sort of, as Dave had expressed to me, really, you know, one of the goals of the talk is to get people speaking about the research that they've done here. So I want to talk about Nevada. So the lottery to me is a fascinating sociological problem to the extent that it really sort of hits, if we kind of think about social problems as Venn diagrams where two big circles overlap with one another. So on the one hand, we have kind of the big circle of gaming as a social problem. So here we can look at sort of historical treatments like Dombrich and Thompson's The Last Resort. We can look at Dave's Roll the Bones, which talk about sort of the historical evolution of gaming, right? Its ebb and flow, the fits and starts that happen along the way. We can look at books like, say, Jeff Salaz's The Labor of Luck, which talk about the ways in which, through sort of increased licensing and regulations, casinos have increasingly become perceived as clean, right, that they are corporations now, and indeed how this sort of shapes the experience of being on the gaming floor. So indeed, right, this whole question about sort of the notion of sort of gaming itself, right, this is one particular kind of constructed social problem. But the second key problem that I think we need to think about, right, this sort of being our second big circle here, is about the problem of state intervention. So here, you know, as a sociologist, I think about books like Theda Skocpol's Protecting Soldiers and Mothers, which is sort of, it describes the emergence of America's social welfare and social security policies. I think about a book like Rick Fantasy and Kim Voss's Hard Work, which describes kind of the unfolding of labor law. And I think we can even sort of look at this if we just again sort of go back to the very recent past of the last month and think about sort of the Supreme Court debates around sort of Obama's Affordable Care Act, right? This was very much a story about sort of what it means for the state to intervene in what we imagine to be kind of public markets. And so the lottery to me is not like other kinds of gaming because it's where these two big circles intersect, right? Here's what's distinctive about the lottery, right? The lottery is fascinating to me because it is a site where the state has to act not just as a regulator, but as the proprietor of a gaming operation. Right, this is what makes it really fascinating and distinct, right? And it creates huge dilemmas, I think, for the practices of both normalizing and defining lottery markets. And so in recognizing that then, you know, just to kind of give you my own sort of very quick sketch outline, lotteries were widespread in the United States through the latter part of the 19th century until the sort of huge scandals and corruption of the Louisiana lottery led the federal government to intervene in 1895, prohibiting the use of the U.S. mail system to distribute and disseminate information or lottery tickets. And so we went through about a 70-year sort of period of abeyance of lotteries until 1964, right? To me, this is sort of the ushering in of the modern lottery era, right, when New Hampshire re-entered the lottery marketplace. And so in a matter of 50 short years, perhaps that's not short, but it's short to me, only seven states don't offer lotteries now. They are Alabama, Alaska, Hawaii, Mississippi, Utah, Wyoming, and Nevada. 90% of the population currently live in states that offer lotteries. It has become quite conventional. And so the Massachusetts lottery really has been a forerunner in a lot of ways. Massachusetts entered the marketplace in 1971, and although they are limited by state law in terms of how and where they can advertise, the lottery has been tremendously successful. So, you know, when I think lottery, I'm thinking Keno games, I'm thinking sort of lotto styles, pick five out of seven numbers, I'm thinking instant scratch tickets. So in Massachusetts, it's quite striking here. The games are economically critical to the state. In fiscal year 2009, the Massachusetts State Lottery sold $4.4 billion worth of tickets. Of that, it yielded $859 million in profits, which was allocated for local aid. The Massachusetts Lottery has been technologically innovative. I mean, they are remarkable about their efforts to really do things in-house, designing new games, thinking about sort of technology infrastructure. They have made a very concerted point of trying to manage these things in-house. The Massachusetts Lottery, I would also suggest to you, is administratively efficient. Their operating costs are less than 2% of total revenues every year. This is amazing. And what I think is also quite important is that the lottery is politically powerful in Massachusetts. So when we've gone through our most recent sort of legalization debate about whether or not to sort of offer casino gaming in Massachusetts, the state lottery is sufficiently powerful and sufficiently important that they actually were able to portray both their portfolio of games and the money that they generate for local aid as being potentially at risk, right? That the lottery itself became a stakeholder in the debate about sort of unfolding casino gaming in Massachusetts. And so let's think then here about our comparative case of Nevada and the Nevada State Lottery. And here's why I think it's an amazingly interesting case, is because it doesn't exist. This, to me, is amazingly interesting. And yet, if we think again about this modern lottery era, right, since 1964, there have actually been a number of what I would call close misses. And so let me just kind of tick off a few of those. The first actually happened in 1966 to 1968. A group called the Silver State Sweepstakes got enough signatures on a petition to actually sort of to offer a statewide initiative to actually establish a lottery. Fascinating. I pulled some advertisements out here. So there was actually not a lot of sort of public debate around this time. Governor Laxalt and the Attorney General came out sort of quite strongly opposed to the lottery at that point. But there was indeed a bit of advertising. This is an ad from The Sun opposing the lottery. It says, "A deal so outrageous, it's hard to believe it's possible. You're asked to vote on a, in quotation marks, state lottery, but it's a private scheme promoted from out of state," right? A little bit of sort of fear-mongering here. By contrast, right, interestingly enough, the argument in favor sort of came in sort of saying, "Warning, someone wants to take your money," right? "The costs of state government have gone up. Somebody has to pay the bill. The already rich establishment," I'll insert parenthetically, when you hear that, you should think casinos, "wants you to pay because they won't. They don't have the interests of Nevada in their hearts. They are taxed at a maximum of 5.5% of their gross, while the lottery pays 30% of the gross to the state. Off the top, to protect their interests, they've attacked the lottery with a smokescreen laid down by public figures they support." So, interestingly enough, voters in Nevada in 1968, it wasn't even close. I mean, the lottery petition and sort of the lottery initiative, rather, lost by a rather wide margin. Again, in 1981 to 1983, there were some efforts in the legislature to create a provision for a charitable lottery. But while it passed the 81 session after being heavily reworked and sort of curtailing who was a bona fide charity able to offer these games, the bill did indeed make it to the 83 session, but it ultimately died there in legislative committee. Then there was a period in 90 to 91, actually, where sort of the state constitution was amended to allow for charitable gaming. But again, sort of who constituted a charity, the extent of the games that they would get to offer was fairly narrow. And then again, we have the debate, I would say, of the last couple of years as we've entered this most recent period of recession, where again, there have been conversations about the desirability and feasibility of a state lottery. And so that's what I really want to spend the difference of our time talking about today. And so really to look at sort of the shape of debates in Nevada from the last 50 years. And so again, I want to think about patrons, right? Who's playing the game? Proceeds, what happens with the money, and proprietors. And so when I talk about each of those, I'm going to move through the first two relatively quickly and just focus on kind of the against lottery argument. I'm happy to elaborate on those if you have questions at the end, but really I want to get to what I think is kind of the crux and the most interesting piece of this presentation, which is really to focus upon the role that the state and proprietors play. So with that, thinking about patrons, right, the main argument that gets made against sort of implementing a state lottery is that it is a regressive tax, right? That it is a moment of kind of reverse Robin Hood where disproportionately poor people and people of color play, and that sort of the benefits through the state accrue to those who are whiter and more wealthy. So for example, in a 2005 legislative hearing, Assemblyman R. Garn Mabee invoked exactly this kind of argument in sort of testifying against the proposed state lottery. Here's what he said. "I will share some research that I have found. Rubric item number 1, lower income groups bear a disproportionately high tax burden. Number 2, players with household incomes under $10,000 per year bet nearly 3 times as much as those with incomes over $50,000 a year. Point number 3, sales of the Georgia lottery tickets are 2.5 times higher in poor neighborhoods than in affluent ones. Lotteries there intentionally saturate impoverished neighborhoods with outlets, know exactly where their most loyal and desperate customers are. Point 4, those with the least education spend the most on lottery, although they did not play more often." Similarly, in a April 2012 response to an article in the Las Vegas Sun, here's what one commentator offered. They wrote, quote, "Lotteries are, in effect, an incredibly regressive tax. Educated people understand that the odds of winning are about the same," I like this, "as being mauled by a polar bear and a grizzly bear on the same day, so they don't play. Rather than rely on a scheme that preys on lower-income people, I'd rather see a competitive reform of our revenue structure in Nevada. We can begin with mining. And so I think always this argument gets invoked, right? It certainly did in Massachusetts, somehow arguing that sort of people who play lotteries are ignorant of math. Articles always kind of invoke kind of the fun, playful, what is more likely than winning the lottery statistic. So in this piece from the Las Vegas Weekly from last week, you know, here's the one that I liked. Odds of being killed by a vending machine in any given year, 112,000 to 1. Much better than the 176 million to 1 odds of winning the lottery. So again, this argument that somehow sort of people who are mathematically challenged, right, those who are, again, sort of uneducated and poor, are going to be sort of the main folks who are sort of playing and being taken advantage of by, preyed upon indeed by the state through lotteries. And yet, I think this denies a certain lived reality of how lotteries work. As I was sort of mentioning a little bit earlier, this is just for lotto-style games, right? So again, pick 5 out of a field of 59 numbers plus the Powerball. This is actually not where the bread and butter of most state lotteries are happening now. Really, since the early 1990s, Massachusetts has sold significantly more instant scratch tickets than they have lotto-style tickets. Right? So out of that $4.4 billion of lottery ticket sales in Massachusetts last year, just north of $2 billion actually came from instant scratch tickets. So again, right, you know, we think about kind of sort of these sort of as being somehow kind of different from the lottery or sort of the lotto, and yet they are still part of what's going on. And what Massachusetts has, to their credit, figured out is that what players actually want from these kinds of games is more frequent, smaller denomination victories. Right? So you may not win $600 million. You may not win $10 million. You may not even win $1 million. But you can win $200. You can win $500. Indeed, even for the $1 denomination tickets, which have the poorest odds for scratch tickets in Massachusetts, you at least break even 1 out of every 5 games. This is not people being mathematically challenged, right? This is the market in Massachusetts and other states dictating that this is precisely what people want, to win more often and smaller value victories. So again, I think players in reality are very savvy, but these arguments in sort of the lottery context portray them as being naive, as stupid, and as backwards. So again, this is kind of one major argument kind of against the lottery, at least in terms of thinking about sort of the patrons. Let's think about sort of proceeds for a second, right? What happens with the dollars that sort of would be gained through a potential Nevada state lottery? And so over the last 50 years, Nevada lottery proposals, I think very interestingly, have never suggested that the money should go into kind of the general fund. Rather, they've always sort of been focused upon sort of programming the money for specific good causes, right? I mean, these are kind of feel-good, happy sunshine, free puppies kind of efforts, right? So these are things like support for the elderly, education, benefits for senior citizens, funding veterans' homes, right? Potentially even lowering property taxes, right? These are the kinds of feel-good initiatives that sort of widely distribute the benefits from a lottery, or sort of, you know, sort of more specifically target them, but target them to sort of feel-good populations. And so Nevada, much like Massachusetts, had always kind of invoked these sort of arguments for the lottery. And so when we think about arguments against the lottery as it relates to proceeds, typically what we see is a splitting of differences, right? Where it's kind of a hate the player, not the game sort of moment, right? We really agree with the cause, but not doing it through the lottery. So here's a wonderful for example, right? Where they agree with the ends, but argue that a lottery is an inefficient means to raise funds. This comment is taken from Nevada Senator Maurice Washington, also at a 2005 hearing. And so here again, he's talking about what's happening with the proceeds. He said, quote, "If we're going to be honest with ourselves and we want to fund education, the lottery is the worst way we can go. If we want to fund education and have everyone participate statewide, why not amend the Constitution and do away with the present amendment, which states no personal income tax, and institute a personal income tax? If we want to do something, this is an offer on the table." Right, and I think in this moment, Senator Washington, like many of his peers over the last 50 years, have argued that regardless of what we think the causes are, be they homes for veterans, be they sort of, you know, benefiting education, be they benefiting senior citizens, that the lottery is not an appropriate mechanism to do this. That is, we should somehow have the political will to achieve these goals through other less problematic mechanisms. And so again, what's fascinating to me is that these are absolutely comparable with the shape of arguments that took place in Massachusetts around both sort of who's going to be playing and what's going to happen with the money. But again, we come to this moment about proprietors. And this to me is the key really sort of difference between Massachusetts and Nevada. And this is actually where I want to suggest to you that sequence really matters. Right? So as we again think back about those ways, right? So Massachusetts, 1930s pari-mutuel, 1970s lottery, now casinos. Right? Nevada, by contrast, went casinos in the 1930s, pari-mutuel wagering in the 70s, and are just now debating lotteries. For me, this is where sequencing really sort of comes into play. And so when we have a situation where sort of the order is what it is in Nevada, I think this has sort of inflected the ways in which the state's role as both regulator and proprietor of a would-be lottery really come into play. And so here, as we talk about the proprietors, I really do want to weigh both sides of the debate. So we're going to talk a little bit about the argument both for the lottery and against the lottery as we think about proprietors. And so one of the central arguments in terms of sort of thinking about and sort of articulating an argument in favor of establishing a state lottery is to say, don't worry about the casino industry and the state should do the right thing that ultimately the people want. Oftentimes they invoke a variety of sort of polls and statistics showing widespread public support for the lottery, arguing in favor of moving in this direction. So in 1985, a citizen by the name of Doris Lubavitch handwrote an op-ed column which she sent to her state senator, and she invoked this argument about sort of the state doing the right thing and not worrying about the casino industry. And she wrote, "To those who truly care about our state's future, our highways, schools, parks, etc., should stand up and demand from the gaming industry that they quit giving us a song and dance about business being down and not being able to afford a tax increase." Right? This sort of coming out in that 1981 to 85 moment where there was some conversation going on about sort of a lottery coming into play. Former Senator Joe Neal, right? Joe Neal being someone who oftentimes introduced a Senate bill to sort of to repeal the Constitution's prohibition. In a 2007 oral history, he invoked this idea of the importance of the state standing up to the gaming industry. And so he weighs in on this topic saying, quote, "The question is, can you, right, can the legislature stand up? Yes, but will you? I don't think so, because as long as the legislator feels that there's something about that title that enhances his prestige, then he knows that he has to go to gaming to get money in order to maintain that prestige. He's not going to fight it to gain it. You would often hear, why bite the hand that feeds you? And the other statement you normally hear is, why kill the goose that laid the golden egg? And my position has been, since I hear that most often, if the goose is crapping all over the place, then you have to get some of the gold to help clean up the mess." Clever turn of phrase. But I think both of these speak to a certain general frustration that somehow the political system itself is broken, right? And it's imbalanced, right? That there's an asymmetry here towards the needs and interests of casinos. And there is this sort of notion that somehow state politics have to move towards greater fairness and equity. Similarly here, you know, there is an argument sort of being made about sort of, you know, sort of the desirability of a casino, right? So in sort of, again, in a very recent letter to the editor of the Las Vegas Review-Journal, one person wrote, thinking back to this milieu that we've been discussing earlier, quote, "After returning home from buying Mega Millions lottery tickets in Prim, I watched a newscast in which they interviewed one of MGM's bigwigs. He said casinos bring in billions of dollars a year, much more than a lottery. But we can have both. I gamble in the casinos, but I also take a flyer on lottery tickets, too. MGM's argument is shallow and lame. There are at least 40 states in our country that have lotteries, and many of those states also have casino gambling. Yet it doesn't deter people from gambling in their state's casinos and still coming to Las Vegas. It's clear that the lawmakers in Nevada are in bed with the casino industry. But it's time for them to do what's right. Polls show that 98% of Nevadans want a lottery like Mega Millions and Powerball here." Right, so again, you know, in this moment, they're suggesting that, again, the lottery is actually what the majority of Nevadans want. That, you know, when they look out to kind of other places in the American landscape, they see casinos coexisting with lotteries. And again, I think this is one of those moments where sequence really does come to matter. Because, interestingly enough, in a 1995 report that Hara wrote, right, 95 being a moment when a lot of states were getting into the commercial gaming industry, they were building riverboat casinos, oftentimes whether those were actual riverboats or the boats and moats versions. And so Harrah's, as being one of the major players in that industry, wanted to assuage the fears of state lottery commissions and show that these things were not zero sum. And so they opened their paper with a question, right? The question asks, how will legalization of riverboat or other casinos affect a state's lottery? And their answer is that data from across the United States suggests that the operation of commercial casinos does not have a significant adverse effect on state lottery revenues. In fact, much more often than not, lottery revenues grow following the introduction of casino gaming. This is from Harrah's in 1995. And yet this is the same Harrah's that sort of makes the argument about sort of the impossibility of sort of bringing in a lottery to the state of Nevada, right? This is where sequence matters an awful lot. So again, these are some of the arguments that sort of get made in favor of the state doing what's right, sort of acting sort of in the interest of the majority of Nevadans, and legalizing a state lottery. But here's the other side of that equation, right? Here's invoking sort of against the lottery, in effect arguing the central contention here being that the state is an unfair competitor. So let's take two quotes from William Bible, right? The first from 1992, when he was chairman of the State Gaming Control Board and addressing the Legislative Commission's subcommittee to study gaming. In this address, he talked about how 33 states and D.C. at that time had legalized lotteries, and he presented some projections about possible revenues if Nevada implemented its own lottery. However, he cautioned the commission, right? He cautioned the committee that the issue of legalized lottery must be given intensive study because of its possible ramifications on the gaming industry, right? This is sort of when William Bible, in 92, was acting as the chairman of the State Gaming Control Board. Let's jump forward 15 years and revisit William Bible, now in his role as president of the Nevada Resort Association in 2007, where he's offering input about the prospect of legalized lotteries. He stated, quote, "We are concerned about funding this measure that will create a competitive situation where the state becomes the competitor to the state's principal industry, gaming. There will be a drop-off in gambling and other revenues if you implement a lottery in Nevada." Similarly, in 1983, Edward Nigro, I always mangle names, so I'm sure I've done that one, he being president of the Silver Nugget Casino, wrote a letter to Senators James Bilbray and Wilbur Face, who had been championing the effort to sort of establish a charitable casino provision. And he wrote to them invoking some of these same ideas that Bible did. He wrote, quote, "I must strongly state my belief that a statewide lottery would dilute the income of an already weakened statewide casino economy. We need not compete as a state government with one sector of private enterprise that has provided broad-based tax revenues from which our state has for such a long time benefited." He continues later, "It seems almost ironic that during the only period that I can recall," right, remembering that sort of 83 was kind of a moment of recession, at least for sort of the casino industry, "it seems almost ironic that during the only period that I can recall in which the casino industry has stumbled somewhat, the immediate reaction of our state government is to provide not assistance, but additional taxes that we must pay, and now potentially the ultimate blow of direct competition." Similarly, in 2009, Leslie Pittman, who was a lobbyist for station casinos, weighed in sort of, again, arguing against sort of the unfairness and sort of the inequality of the state becoming a competitor to the gaming industry. Pittman argued, quote, "To begin, we believe that a lottery would put the state of Nevada in the gambling business, pitting the state against its largest private employer, largest property taxpayer, and largest purchaser of goods and services. Now is not the time for the state legislature to make a conscious choice to make it more difficult for the gaming industry to regain its financial health." Think about these comments over the period of about 30 years from William Bible and Edward Nigro in the early 80s, on through sort of Pittman and some of the other lobbyists for casinos in 2009, the argument sort of against the lottery as it relates to the proprietors, as it relates to the states, has really not changed at all, right? It's always sort of invoking this idea that somehow there's sort of a fundamental unfairness to the state sort of coming in and competing with, again, sort of the state's largest taxpayer, its largest employer, its biggest industry, right? That somehow sort of, you know, that sort of what this represents is sort of profoundly unfair to the gaming industry. And so let's think about this sort of in contrast one more time to Massachusetts. The debate about proprietors in Massachusetts really sort of took on a very sort of qualitatively different bent. That by the 1970s, Massachusetts had a very robust paramutual industry. In particular, the Greyhound racing sort of tracks were sort of very well capitalized. But the main concern here wasn't about the state unfairly competing in these gaming markets. By contrast, there was much more public concern about the state losing its status, again, invoking this phrase, as the Athens of America. Right, that somehow sort of, you know, getting the state into sort of being not just a regulator but a proprietor of gaming operations would be mixing it up with sort of the people who ran sort of criminal numbers rackets taking the place of gangsters somehow. Right, this is profoundly different in these two milieus. So again here, right, what were our arguments? Let's take one more step back. So this project broadly is about waves of gaming legalization, right? Looking at sort of, you know, the things that have taken place, not simply in Massachusetts, but across the United States, and seeing the lottery as a particular kind of problem, right? And it's a particular kind of gaming problem, not only because there's gaming involved, but we have the role of state as both regulator and proprietor. And so I think even in the absence of a state-run lottery in Nevada, we can learn an awful lot from looking at the trajectory of debates in Nevada. So between Nevada and Massachusetts, we see a parallel in terms of the discourse about patrons, right? Especially as we kind of think about sort of the opposition to lotteries, right? There's concerns about the lottery, in effect, being a bad math tax, right? That it is sort of a punitive measure, it is regressive, that it would take advantage of the poor and the people of color. This is very synonymous in Massachusetts as it is in Nevada, right? Although separated by 40 years, right? This is a parallel moment. In the same kind of way, there's sort of a parallel moment in thinking about proceeds. What is going to happen with the revenues that casinos generate? And in both cases, we see states having to sort of to articulate a really compelling story about how lottery revenues are going to be allocated to the benefit of the general public. Right. So in Massachusetts, this dialogue went on around sort of returning money back to local aid. Right. So, you know, when Massachusetts sort of passed its lottery bill, this was done in lieu of further increasing property taxes. And so, you know, when it sort of came time then for sort of local governments to balance their budgets, the lottery money became sort of the key part of local aid dollars that flowed back from the state. And so this was, you know, so this money went out to all 351 cities and towns around Massachusetts and was seen as sort of, you know, widely distributing the benefits of the lottery. And so indeed, we see this also in Nevada, right, where over the course of the last 50 years, you know, the proposals, especially in the last few years, have sort of focused on education. But even think about this moment in sort of starting in the early 80s, stretching into the early 90s, where finally the Constitution actually was amended to allow for charitable organizations, right, charitable and nonprofit groups to run lotteries. Right, and again, it was very narrowly constrained in terms of what qualified as an actual charitable organization, what kinds of games could they run, how large could the prizes be. But nonetheless, you know, I think even in this moment of sort of being able to pass a charitable lottery bill, it signaled a certain kind of the importance of sort of showing how these lottery dollars are going to go out to benefit the public as a whole. But we find the moment of divergence when it comes to proprietors, right? And this is where, to me, right, Massachusetts and Nevada, parallel timelines, different sequence. This is where sequence really matters, right? Massachusetts, again, sees the state, or sort of the concerns about the state are really about selling its reputation by becoming involved in gaming. But Nevada, it really sort of portrays the state as being somehow an unfair competitor, right? That the state won't create as many jobs, that the state is damaging the number one industry And so I think what's interesting is that there's this sort of tacit and sometimes even explicit moment throughout of somehow suggesting that the state has an unearned advantage in sort of participating in these recreational gaming markets, right? That simply by its very presence that the state will sort of come to be the dominant player. And so, again, you know, to come back to where we started today, what I think is so striking when I read the articles from the last few weeks posing this question, why does Nevada not have a state lottery? All of them begin with the assumption that it's not a question of morality, right? We already have legalized casinos, right? We have sports books. We can bet on horses, right? The morality question of lotteries is out the window. And yet, what I want to suggest to you, by way of closing, is that I actually think there is still a very moral dimension to these arguments about the lottery in Nevada. And to me, this is kind of a unique reflection on, again, not just sequencing, but the time that we live in, right? And which is to say that now, I think in sort of a neoliberal era, markets themselves are privileged, right? That there is a sanctity and sort of a celebration of markets, right? That markets are the way that we confer value, that markets are sort of the manner in which we come to sort of recognize sort of exchanges of sort of utility, that I think sort of, you know, integral to all of these critiques, especially in Nevada, right, is the fact that sort of, you know, regardless of sort of, you know, the potential success or failure, I mean, because the projections that are sort of offered about how much the Nevada State Lottery might earn sort of range rather widely, what I think is so integral to all of these critiques of the state as a proprietor is that somehow they are sort of interfering with private markets, right? And that this is, for our world that we live in now, a moral moment. And so when I think we look at waves, we always have to recognize that moments of sort of economic difficulty or adversity have been moments for the expansion of gaming, right? So think about wave one, 1930s, Great Depression, right? Massachusetts, pari-mutuel wagering, Nevada casinos, right? Clearly in direct response. 1970s, right? Another moment of sort of significant recessions, right? Massachusetts did a lottery, Nevada went pari-mutuel wagering. And now we come back to this most recent moment, right? The recession that's been sort of, theoretically it's finished now, right? But in principle and I think in practice for most people, it's still going on. And in this sort of most recent recession, Massachusetts moved finally after sort of debating this really since the very late 1970s about getting into the casino gaming marketplace. Finally, after, you know, the better part of 30 years, Massachusetts legalized casinos. And in the same kind of way, Nevada is still having the ongoing debate about lotteries. But as much as sort of the recession makes it plausible, or at least sort of possible, for Nevada to think about sort of expanding into a state lottery, I think the sequencing makes it at least sort of implausible at the moment, right? That is to say that the very existence of kind of a well-organized, sort of heavily capitalized casino gaming industry, that even in sort of a moment of significant economic hardship for the state, it makes it incredibly challenging for them to sort of to move forward and do the lottery. So you asked me the question earlier, I'll end with this. I think invariably it's coming. You know, if you're sort of asking for my opinion, I think Nevada will indeed have a state lottery. Don't ask me to say when, because otherwise I probably wouldn't be standing here in front of you, but I think invariably it will come. I mean, my sense is that sort of the durability of kind of this markets as moral argument is going to wane as kind of the recession grinds on and sort of people feel less inclined to sort of to see the current tax structure here as sort of being unfair and asymmetrical. So with that, I say thank you. I appreciate your time, and I would love to hear your questions. No, thank you. Markets as moral and the Nevada State Lottery. What do you think?
So how many proposals have there been since 1975? I've read a couple different things. I read 30, and then I thought I read 24 in a newspaper article.
I've actually been working on trying to sort of put together a chronology of exactly those this week. I think the number probably lies somewhere in between. And so we kind of have thicker moments where, again, sort of, you know, there was a clustering in the early 80s. There was a clustering in the early 90s. There's sort of been a clustering as of late. But then more or less, not every legislative session, but most in between, someone has sort of introduced a measure sort of potentially, you know, repealing or sort of overturning the constitutional prohibition. So My sense, although it's incomplete still, is that it's probably somewhere right in between those. Yeah. But again, to me, what's fascinating is that, you know, the thicker moments of possibility have indeed tended to sort of cluster, right? I mean, and so we see moments where sort of the legislation moves a little bit further forward because, again, I think sort of the broader conditions at least sort of make it, again, sort of potentially feasible, if not totally plausible, given the circumstances that the state is in. And again, the other really striking thing is that in all of these moments, I can't actually think of one off the top of my head, all of the bills that the legislature has considered program the dollars to do something particular, right? That they aren't just dollars into the general fund. They are dollars towards a particular outcome on the other end, trying to, again, sort of address this issue about sort of proceeds.
Usually earmarked toward education.
It's very popular, right? I mean, this is really, you know, when we kind of think about sort of the spread of lotteries across the United States and in particular kind of through the Bible Belt states, you know, the education lottery was kind of the go-to model there in terms of sort of overcoming sort of, again, sort of the moral arguments in those states, right? Because who can argue with sort of, you know, seeing the kids as our future, right? So, right, Georgia being sort of a wonderful, for example, right, sort of taking their lottery money and sort of putting it towards their Hope Scholarship program. You know, one of the interesting sort of proposals, I believe in the early 80s in Nevada, was arguing that they were going to sort of divide the would-be lottery revenues equitably between class size reduction, increased resources for the schools themselves, so textbooks, materials, etc., and then another third out to senior citizens aid. But yeah, education is kind of the big go-to here, as it has been in other states.
Is there a book out there that's kind of an ultimate authority on going through all the proposed legislation and what the money's earmarked for?
In Nevada or nationwide?
For Nevada.
No. I would love to say that there is, but, you know, the big national book that everyone tends to go to is called Selling Hope by Clotfelder, Clotfelder, and Cook. It was
Selling Hope,
right, about state lotteries. That is sort of, you know, kind of the definitive scholarly text. If you want kind of a lighter version of that, there's a book called Lottery Wars. It's kind of a more sort of popular trade version that kind of walks through, in some ways, the similar trajectory. But yeah, I mean, most of the treatments are indeed kind of national cases rather than specific to Nevada. If you find a Nevada case on the lottery, I would love to read it. I mean, again, this is what's interesting, right? I mean, there's something about kind of the absence of data that tells us something that is indeed going on here. Yes, sir.
Did you say that you touched on how the economy is affecting the discussion of how a lottery is in Nevada? Do you feel that the longer the recession lasts, the less likely the lottery will happen, or the opposite?
You know, it's kind of fascinating where, again, you know, I like to think about sort of, this is an awful thing to say, I sound like Mitt Romney, I don't care about recessions and people being unemployed. No, I mean, I care about these things both as kind of a person and a scholar, but, you know, when I'm thinking about kind of sort of possibilities for legalization, to me, it's less sort of causal than it is sort of correlative. And so, you know, so I, you know, as I was sort of, we were talking about earlier today, you know, Massachusetts was so sort of fascinating about its ambivalence to legalize gaming. So in the 80s, they started by thinking about sort of, you know, placing a couple of land-based casinos in resort areas. So maybe kind of one out on the Cape, maybe one out sort of further west in the state in the Berkshires, and nothing ever really came to pass. In the 90s, they did what all state governments did was, you know, they thought about riverboat casinos, right? You know, maybe seven in the Boston Harbor, eight others around the state, maybe going out of kind of the South Shore, others sort of plying the rivers inland. And again, you know, it never came to pass. And so, you know, when Deval Patrick in 2007 said, in for an inch, in for a mile, if the Wampanoag tribe is going to do this, then we want the state to kind of do full-fledged resort destination casinos. It took 3 years for the bill to really make much headway through the legislature, in part because the former speaker of the Massachusetts House, his district included the major thoroughbred racing track in the state. And so until he was out of office, which he, like I think our last three speakers now have left under criminal indictments usually, the bill wasn't moving forward. But the really fascinating thing that happened in Massachusetts, right, so is that finally, you know, there were sort of debates going back and forth, right, four casinos, three casinos, how do we deal with kind of the set-aside? Do we do sort of the racinos, right, a slot parlor as kind of a middle step? So finally, you know, the Senate wanted, I'm trying to remember, I think the Senate wanted three casinos and no slot parlors. I think the House wanted four plus two. And so they finally sort of got together in 2010. They agreed on a reconciled bill in literally the last hours of the legislative session. They sent it to Deval Patrick. He said in principle he was very happy with it. And the amazing thing about the Massachusetts legislature, or sort of, I'm sorry, Massachusetts politics in general, is that they snatched defeat from the jaws of legislative victory, where Deval Patrick said he decided he didn't want the slot parlors, that they were kind of too lowbrow for the kinds of economic development that Massachusetts was going to do. And so he actually sent the bill back to the legislature. Their session was over. The speaker and the president of the Senate refused to kind of to bring their colleagues back. And so the bill literally died, although there was some great degree of consensus. So to me, I don't think it was about sort of the duration of the recession that made it possible then in sort of 2011 for Massachusetts to pass its casino bill. I think it, again, that was facilitating, but it wasn't causal, right? Again, I think it was sort of about the broader alignment of political forces and the way these debates shaped up. Again, thinking about sort of fairness, what's going to happen with the money, how are we going to sort of indemnify the state lottery in certain ways, who will get to do this, what will the process be? And so my sense is that the trajectory would be very similar in Nevada, where I think the longer that it goes on, it incentivizes certain kinds of conversations, but I don't necessarily know that that by itself will sort of, you know, sort of be the straw that breaks the camel's back, so to speak. Yes, sir.
In your research, have you seen any influence from third parties? Because you say Nevada, you know, it's the state between the gaming industry. Do you see any other agents, not agents, governments, like the state of California, which has a stake in the line? I mean, I lived it by myself with the Mega Millions. I saw the lights in print, and the people who couldn't make it in print went to Baker. So it's something, you know, that it, you know, a lottery in Nevada might, you know, have a negative effect, you know, in California.
Absolutely. And you know, it is kind of striking. I mean, when we this is why I think, you know, sort of looking at these moments as being waves is really actually quite useful, right? I mean, and so I think about the Northeast where, you know, almost invariably what has happened is kind of one state will legalize a form of gaming, whether it was pari-mutuel in the 30s or the lottery in kind of the late 60s, starting with New Hampshire and now casinos. And then it will kind of spread out and sort of diffuse to all of these sort of adjacent states. And so, you know, what we're seeing in this moment is, I'll sort of answer your question in sort of in the Massachusetts context, is that as Massachusetts has been weighing the casino bill, you certainly saw gaming interests sort of coming into the state, right? I mean, so Steve Wynn and others, you know, sort of came to make their case in Massachusetts for how the rules should be configured and what the competition should look like and, you know, how we should sort of adjudicate between sort of the relative proposals. The fascinating thing then is that, but then you also have kind of vested interests that sort of may or may not move. So I'm thinking about sort of the two tribal casinos in Connecticut. So the casino run by the Mashantucket Pequot Nation and the other run by the Mohegan tribe. You know, both of those, you know, have really strong opinions about kind of the presence of casinos in Massachusetts. And certainly they were active in lobbying the state legislature to try and sort of forestall, to hold off, to adjust the rules to work in their favor. I mean, this has absolutely been the case. To a certain extent, state governments haven't so much weighed in, although they have been reactively legislating now. So once Massachusetts passed its casino law, Rhode Island said that they were thinking about going from Class 2 to Class 3 gaming. Connecticut's governor has already said that he wants that they want to go back and reconfigure their compacts with the two tribes to broaden out gaming. New Hampshire, Maine have all said that they're going to go back and revisit their gaming legislation because they recognize that they're competing for, in some ways, the same sets of players. So it certainly is the case. You know, it's fascinating. There was I read a policy paper from the Legislative Research Bureau that I believe was published in 1990, and it looked at the the relative impact of sort of the creation of the California State Lottery, right, which was approved in 85, they did their first drawing in 86, on the Nevada gaming industry. And trying to sort of parse out the effects of how did one impact the other, right? Because what Nevada actually found in looking at its data was after the California lottery opened up, the revenues actually declined across all type. Well, the general industry revenues declined. You know, what I thought was interesting, though, is that sort of the legislative analyst report actually sort of parsed the results a little bit further and found that, you know, the decline was not so much caused by the sort of the creation of the California lottery. I mean, potentially this had maybe a little bit of the dip, but the bigger factor was Nevada passing Prop 6A about sort of money laundering and having to disclose certain cash transactions over $10,000, right? This was Nevada's sort of state-level reaction to kind of the federal money laundering laws. And so they argued that that was actually the greater impact on sort of declining state revenues, because what they found is actually sort of revenues at table games and other games, table games dropped off precipitously, but revenues at slots held pretty much consistent, if not went up slightly during this period of time. So their argument was that in some ways, right, I mean, you know, all of these sort of forms of gaming, you know, sort of were not cannibalizing one another, but, you know, it was actually sort of Nevada's own state regulation of the gaming industry that led to sort of the decline of revenues. That said, politicians are very aware of these things, right? I mean, they're critically sort of cognizant of sort of the loss of dollars, especially in this environment. So yeah, it's clearly on their agenda. You know, clearly interest groups are sort of weighing into these conversations as well. But no, it's something that I think, you know, I can continue to sort of draw out more in the analysis. Anything else you want to talk about? Do you guys think it's coming? Is it coming?
I think so. Eventually.
Yeah. When is eventually? Is a lottery coming to Nevada?
I'm ambivalent towards it. I don't really care. But probably, considering the environment, I don't think it's that radical to suggest a lottery. At this current time.
What do you think, sir? Lottery's coming?
I don't think that the state is too adept to deal with a lottery.
They have sort of a world-leading regulatory regime for sort of the casino industry. How could they not be fully prepared to deal with sort of the logistics of a lottery?
You know, they know all about casinos, but as you said, casinos and lotteries are kind of two different things. They, you know, it's not in a set building casino.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's diffuse, right? I mean, and this to me is also one of the really fascinating things, right? I mean, you know, we talk about kind of, you know, the lottery as being sort of state-run and state-operated, but I was telling Dave about this over lunch. You know, I think it's so interesting because in Massachusetts, the state sells very few of its own tickets directly, you know, but instead they rely on sort of a network of sort of brokers and salespeople. So, I mean, the most common things are, you know, you can go to your corner bar and play Keno. You can sort of go to any convenience store and buy your instant win scratch tickets. We actually have sort of automated vending machines in grocery stores where you can sort of buy either lottery tickets, right, that is lotto style tickets, or the scratchers. And so it's fascinating because, you know, when you sort of look at sort of the Massachusetts Lottery Commission's training materials, you know, they really are trying to sort of show that, I mean, this isn't about kind of, it's not as we sort of see in this moment, right, it's not zero sum where it's kind of us or the private marketplace. It is kind of, you know, Massachusetts portrays it as being much more kind of hybridized, you know, that it's a public-private sort of joint enterprise to truly make a lottery successful. But no, I think it's kind of an interesting question, right, about how this works. Is the lottery coming to Nevada?
I hope so.
You hope so? Why do you hope so?
Lottery tickets.
Why do you buy the lottery tickets?
I mean, you never know. If you win just one ticket, you can win. So
right, this wasn't this sort of New York slogan for a long time, right? A dollar and a dream, right? It's all you need. I mean, no, there's something profoundly sort of. I mean, and this sort of goes back to, right, sort of, you know, the, you know, sort of aside from kind of the sort of, you know, lottery being kind of a reverse tax on sort of those who are poor at math. There was actually this really brilliant quote about sort of allowing for smart dreamers, right? You know, that people love, you know, what the lottery says about trying to be able to kind of envision alternate futures. Yeah, I probably can't find it real fast because now I flipped all my pages around. But yeah, no, I mean, I think this idea that, you know, to sit back and imagine, like, what are you going to do with $600 million?
Yeah, it's so fun to, like, just
But it could, right? I mean, and so, yeah, you know, right, I recognize that it's much more likely that I'll be mauled by a grizzly bear than hit by a meteor and then mauled by a polar bear all in the same day, and yet it's fun to dream, right? There's something very attractive about that. Is it coming?
No, I don't think so.
Why not?
There's going to be a different compromise on the subject.
What do you think the alternate compromise will be?
Some other arrangement for the state to collect money.
Income taxes?
No, some probably mathematical raising of the tax on the industry or the gaming industry or some other property taxes.
If they had a lottery, they'd probably end up having the casinos run the lottery.
You know, this is certainly, you know, interesting enough, right? I mean, this has come up repeatedly, especially in the 80s and 90s, right? That sort of, you know, one permutation of a lottery would actually be to sort of to get the casinos to literally and figuratively buy in, right? That they would become those intermediary brokers like we have in Massachusetts of the convenience stores, and that then they get their vague from selling tickets. They would get kind of the sort of the walk-in traffic of people wanting to play the games. Now, I mean, this would sort of potentially kind of be, I could envision that clearly as sort of being a compromise solution too, yeah. That, you know, it sort of, it tries to kind of find the win-win solution, as it were.
Or if it happens, the gaming industry is going to maintain its status, but the local governments are going to be cannibalized, you know. We've seen it before with other tax abatements that the state has, you know, so.
Well, I mean, and this is the interesting thing about sort of earmarking, right, you know, is that, I mean, what a lot of, you know, going back to the question that you had asked earlier about education lotteries, I mean, what sort of, you know, Nevada has sort of raised in a lot of its hearings is that, you know, what we've seen in other contexts is that sort of education lotteries have actually supplanted rather than supplemented those dollars, right? Because, I mean, look, this is the point of sort of Jessica Catalino's High Stakes book, right, is that money is fungible, right? I mean, and so it can be used for a whole variety of different purposes. And so the question is kind of what happens with gaming dollars for her case, you know, once the Florida Seminole acquire them. But no, in this moment, I mean, states, you know, if it's not sort of explicitly spelled out in statute that the money is going to be in addition to the dollars that are getting spent, yeah, a lot of states have found that sort of the education dollars have not increased commensurately with increasing lottery sales. It's just simply meant that the state has spent those dollars elsewhere now instead of having sort of to otherwise sort of, you know. So even if it doesn't go into the general fund, it doesn't matter, people say, because it still ends up doing the same thing, right?
I quote mostly when you say the property taxes, they might lower the property taxes. And, you know, in this town, who pays, you know, the most property taxes, the gaming industry. You know? So that's why I say they're going to cannibalize the local government by reducing completely, you know, the property taxes.
That would just then sort of cause a whole new set of issues, right? Yeah. Yeah, I wonder what the fourth wave is, right? You know, internet gaming. That to me would have sort of become kind of the newer, sort of more fascinating moment. That again, going back to your sort of point about lotteries, right? That I mean, I was thinking about this over the weekend as I was kind of wandering around down on Fremont Street and thinking about in some ways how it's very similar and very different from the experience of playing lottery. But I mean, yeah, can you imagine then sort of kind of the next iteration of this where, you know, suddenly people are sort of playing on their phones at their sort of, you know, legally on their computers at home? You know, how does sort of the regulatory and sort of how does the regulatory structure work there? You know, where do sort of proceeds flow at this moment? Who gets to run those games, man? I think that's going to be sort of a huge question. Yeah. Anyone else want to? Is the lottery coming to Nevada?
I don't know.
You don't know? I think it's coming.
I think as long as the supposed recession is going on or still going on, I think the
It's going to be in the water as at least a possibility of addressing the budgetary concerns, right?
Yeah, I agree.
I think you must get the gaming industry on board, though. That's the only way it's coming, I think.
How does the state frame the argument to get the casino industry on board, right? I mean, because now it really is sort of portrayed as zero sum, right? And to the extent that the state enters, right, it's the immorality of markets, right? It's that somehow, you know, just like, you know, a lot of people are hypercritical of Obama for saying, you know, he's sort of compelling people to sort of buy things and do this, and it's not right for the state to do that. I mean, how does the state frame the story to casinos to make this palatable?
I don't know. You guys were just talking about one thing where, you know, maybe make it where they could only casinos, you know, sell the tickets. So I think in California, don't they get 6%?
6%, yep.
Of every ticket sale.
Yep, so, same in Massachusetts.
The casinos could get the 6% plus all the spending that would go on from all the walk-in traffic. So maybe that would be enough to get them on board. perhaps earmarking money in certain ways too.
I mean, because think about this in the context of sort of those instant scratch games, you know, so going back to what we were sort of alluding to earlier, right, you know, I was thinking about how, like, you wander around on Fremont Street on the weekend, and it's totally different, right? I mean, this is what we kind of think of when we think casinos, right? You know, it's people drinking, you know, it's folks walking around, it's music, you know, it's feel good, you have dancers, you have sort of people sitting, playing, having a good time at various sorts of games. I mean, there's clearly a social dynamic to what's going on here, and so people oftentimes are critical of the lottery as sort of being kind of individualistic, right? It's sort of a lonely person's game. You know, what's interesting to me, though, in some of the ethnographic work that I've done on sort of looking at lottery sales in Massachusetts is that it's actually a profoundly social game, even with sort of the scratch tickets, right? I mean, and so this sometimes is mediated through, like, online fora where people will talk about, like, what's the good game and, you know, how do you sort of know which is the hot ticket to pick? I mean, look, they're talking about hot tickets for things that are sort of already picked and it's kind of just under the foil and you just have to scratch it off. But, I mean, clearly there's a logic going on here. And yet, you know, if you go into sort of, you know, any corner convenience store in Massachusetts that is a lottery retailer, many of them have actually sort of redesigned the front end of their stores to actually sort of be sort of a lottery outlet. And so they have kind of high boy tables where folks can sort of sit. And what they do is people will go, they'll buy their instant scratch tickets, right? You know, $1, $5, $10, $20. And they'll scratch them off. You know, they'll sit, they'll drink some coffee in between. They'll scratch off the tickets. People are smart, right? They know you want to win more often, maybe less money. They win their $20. You know what they do? What do?
Blow it right there.
They walk right back up to the counter. They buy 20 more bucks worth of tickets, right? Wouldn't casinos love to get into that game too, right?
You would think.
I mean, that people aren't walking out. You know, it's not like, oh, I got my 20 and now I'm done. It's, oh, if it's 5, if it's 10, if it's 20, if it's 25, I'm just going to turn that right around and buy more tickets, right? Because it's instantaneous, right? You don't have to wait for Friday for the lotto drawing. It's right then, it's right there. And you know if you win or lose. And you know that your odds are fairly decent to at least break even, right? I think casinos would love to be in on this part of the game.
Yeah. And, like, which casinos, you know? Like, would it be every single casino gets an equal amount of that money? Like, even like, a small little, you know, bar casino?
Well, I mean, so the interesting thing, right, is that, you know, in Massachusetts and most other states, because the state doesn't sell tickets directly, right, and they have to act through intermediaries, they usually give sales agents somewhere in the neighborhood of 6% plus a bonus on big wins, right? You know what I mean? So you sort of, you make money off the top, right? I mean, so it's a plus whatever percent. And so what I think is really interesting is that, to me, that would sort of play right into casinos' wheelhouses where, you know, they have every incentive in the world to try and sort of increase the volume of tickets that they sell. Right? I mean, so you don't want to sell 10 or 15 tickets. You want to sell 1,000, 5,000 tickets. So, I mean, you know, what about a regulatory schema where potentially, you know, the state would say, you know, that, okay, we're all kind of playing the same types of games, but, you know, maybe Circus can offer sort of one type of game versus, you know, sort of the Cosmopolitan that can offer a different kind of game. And then, you know, it's up to the casinos to sell the hell out of their games, right? Why couldn't that be a possibility?
Well, let's say Circus isn't selling that much, and if they want to get in on the other game, they can't anymore.
Mm. Well, I mean,
so
this would
be
sort of
a whole new level of, like, regulations to it.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's what makes it complicated, right? This is where sequence matters a lot, you know, in terms of kind of thinking about, because you have sort of a very sort of politically well-organized and sort of an economically powerful interest group on kind of the other side of this equation, that's where it does become sort of so complex, and especially when sort of those people, plus sort of, you know, sort of a broader set of political allies are all sort of weighing in about kind of the sanctity of markets. Yeah, I think that's why this becomes so hard in Nevada. I still think it's coming, but it's hard. Yeah, I could see a hybrid game. I think you guys are convincing me. I think a system that doesn't somehow include casinos here, I'm hard-pressed to imagine that ever sort of being realistic or viable.
I don't think the casinos are going to let that happen if they're not involved.
Yeah, that they need to be sort of
into the game.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're going to say, you know, it's competition out there, gambling, basically. So
right.
Why do we have to pay that much more?
Yeah.
I mean, their concerns are understandable, you know, because I think a lottery would diminish their take, basically, in the state to a degree. So that's why, you know, there must be incentives for the casino industry to get on board. perhaps something like that, I don't know. Mm. Just allowing them to sell the tickets.
Yeah. Interesting.
I started off thinking, yeah, probably soon there would be a lottery, but now thinking about all this with the casinos or anything, I don't see it happening. Mm. It would just be way too much.
I think it will, maybe not in the near future. I think it's going to happen eventually.
I mean, to me, I think the only thing that sort of begins to trump kind of the markets as moral argument against lotteries is kind of the sort of the tax burden asymmetries and sort of, you know, kind of people's own sort of, you know, fiscal well-being. To me, I think that sort of becomes the trump card that sort of, that allows kind of a reconfiguration of the debate. And so to me, the question is sort of, to what extent does that sort of become more sort of prevalent with potentially kind of an ongoing recession that sort of deepens it? I mean, and this is, again, this is what's so interesting and sort of difficult about Nevada is that, you know, so much of employment is directly or indirectly tied up with casinos that, you know, kind of the health and success of casinos would sort of lead to sort of, you know, better situations there. But then kind of the relative weakness of casinos would also kind of lead to this other moment. So yeah, it again just kind of muddies the water even further, right? That, I mean, again, casinos aren't just sort of political actors here, right? They are employers and sort of economic engines as well. Fascinating. All right, well, thank you guys also very much for the conversation.
This has been the UNLV Gaming Podcast, presented by the Center for Gaming Research at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. The opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily represent those of the Center, UNLV, its faculty, staff, or benefactors. For more information, please see us on the web at gaming.unlv.edu.